In January, thousands of people gathered in Washington Square Park for Kansas City's Women's March. The stage was a platform for all kinds of issues. More than 20 speakers took the stage, talking about religious freedom, gun violence, reproductive rights, and sexual assault.
On February 9th, I woke up in my apartment to find a stranger standing over me, commanding me to get on my stomach, while I lay in the dark in my bed next to my sleeping toddler.
Taylor Hirth stood before this massive crowd and spoke about being raped. She also described what happened when she reported the incident to the Independence Police.
I remember recognizing the doubt in his voice. The officer responding to my rape told the EMTs to hold back because he still had some questions for me. As I held my shaken 2-year-old daughter, he repeatedly asked me if I was on Tinder. He repeatedly asked me if I had invited guys over the night or had a party that night or had been drinking.
Those kinds of questions inspired Taylor to go public with her experience, to send a message to victims.
A truly united States is one where women are no longer afraid to use their voices, no longer afraid of not being believed or supported. One where we have see a hand outstretched without demanding clarification or questioning the validity of the struggle. I know that we are capable of an America that believes all victims of sexual assault, sexual harassment, and for that matter, any kind of oppression. Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. And Taylor is with us now in the studio for KCUR's Central Standard. We're going to hear her perspective on how her case was handled by police, and later we'll hear from others, including a law professor who studies cases like these more broadly, as well as a detective formerly with the Kansas City Police Department. We'll be getting as clear a picture as we can of what happens when rapes are reported in our area and why. Taylor, good morning. Thanks
so
much for being here. What is it like to stand in front of a huge crowd and talk about such a painful memory and such an invasion of your personhood and your privacy?
It was surprisingly a lot easier than I had expected it to be. It was kind of empowering. It gave me kind of a sense of control over my story. And to be able to share my story and to be able to share, you know, parts of stories that have been told to me from other people, I felt like it was really important. It was something I needed to do. So there was never any question.
As you've probably already gathered at this point, Taylor's story has a lot of sensitive and fairly graphic details. So just be forewarned, this may be triggering for some listeners. Taylor, we heard a little bit just now about what happened to you, but tell me about your life at that time. I mean, you were a single mom living at home with your daughter, right?
Mm-hmm.
And where did you live?
I lived in Independence in a little apartment complex off of 24 Highway. And it was a you know, normal apartment complex. We had a pool, and I, you know, waved to my neighbors, and they held the door open for me when I went and got groceries, and everyone was really kind there, and I never felt unsafe. So
how old were you?
I think I was 30.
So in an article about your experience in Cosmopolitan magazine, you talked about being focused on two things while you were being assaulted: on making sure your daughter, who was in the room, didn't perceive that you were being hurt, so protecting her. And you were also channeling some of your mental energy into plans to report what was happening to the police. Talk to me about that second piece of it. What does that mean? What were you paying attention to and why?
Yeah, it was in a big way a distraction from the fact that I might die, that I might be watching my daughter be murdered in front of me. Because at the time, that was a really real possibility in my head. And so instead, I channeled all of my energy into, okay, if we survive this, I need to make sure that I preserve all of the evidence that I possibly can. I can't shower afterwards. I can't brush my teeth afterwards, even though I'm going to want to, and I did want to. I knew I had to try and keep track of my clothes. I had to listen for, you know, their voices, remember any smells that I came across. I was very focused on getting fingerprints because they were so young. I was worried that there wouldn't be any DNA in the system to kind of match them with. So I thought that if we could get fingerprints, it was more likely we'd be able to get a match through fingerprints. So I had them use lubricant in hopes that whatever they touched would leave kind of a sticky residue and be more likely to capture fingerprints. So
how did you know to be thinking about all of this?
That's so hard to explain, because in that moment, it was like my entire existence pulled up into my head and I didn't exist in my body anymore. It was very calculated, and it's crazy how clear everything seemed at the time and how easily I was able to focus in on little things.
You had some volunteering experience that maybe gave you a little more information than, someone who had not had any previous experience with the subject matter. Can you talk to us a little about that?
Yeah, I volunteered with Planned Parenthood, which, you know, very, very active in reproductive rights. And I had worked at a local domestic violence shelter and taken phone calls from rape victims and domestic violence victims. And so we were trained pretty heavily on situations that result in that, and how people respond to that, and what law enforcement needs to be able to investigate and charge a case like that. So
we reached out to the Independence Police Department, but they aren't able to comment on your case because a suspect, that's the word I'm looking for, has now been charged, and the case is in the hands of the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office. And just so people know, you know, our purpose today is really not to get to the bottom of what happened in your case specifically, but we do want to address some of what you dealt with as you went through this process. So what happened from your perspective when you did report this? I understand you started by posting to Facebook as soon as the men left, asking anyone you knew who was online to send police to your apartment. What happened when they arrived?
Yeah, the first thing that happened is they knocked on my door, and I kind of looked through the peephole and opened the door, and they said, "All right, so what happened here?" Like, there was no compassion, there was no humanity involved in it.
What do you imagine would have been like a more appropriate, from your point of view, kind of first thing to say to someone?
Is everybody okay? You know, it's tough to even imagine what the right thing to say would be in that situation. But just even some indication that somebody had been trained properly in how to handle somebody that had just been through a traumatic situation would have been helpful. They kind of just approached me like I was collateral damage or a piece of evidence. And that's kind of how I've felt through this entire process. They began asking me about what had led up to that night, whether I was on Tinder, if I had a husband or a boyfriend.
Tinder is an online dating site that's known for having more of a purpose of hookups than, like,
yeah. Mm-hmm. They asked me if I had thrown a party that night, if I had invited people over and it maybe got out of control. It was a lot of leading questions, like I had forgotten something or I was trying to hide something.
Do you have any guesses as to, like, whether there could be some, some valid motivation behind any of those questions? Or is it just pretty clearly to you, like, no?
You know, I'm sure that they run into people who are afraid, you know, given rape myth and rape culture, that they're afraid to admit that they had maybe been drinking or admit that there was a situation that got out of control. Because in those situations, if you say I had been drinking or yes, I had invited him over and we'd been making out on the couch, then that ends up putting more blame on the victim. And that's kind of how they, you know, deconstruct your case into something that's your fault as opposed to a rape.
Yeah. What are some other things that happened, like when we're still in your apartment before we leave that scene?
The biggest thing that I recall, well, two things. First, the EMTs were told to be held back.
So to not take care of you medically right away?
To not respond to us medically. And at the time, I didn't know if my daughter had been touched. I didn't know. I hadn't even really assessed my own body at that point. I was still very much in my head. They told them to hold back, and then the responding officer proceeded to ask me about my door frame and where the missing pieces of my door frame were. And I had no idea. I didn't even realize my door had been broken into when they were attacking me. It was something that I realized as I walked out in my living room after the fact. And they were very adamant that, well, criminals don't clean up their crime scene. They wouldn't have removed the door frame. And I found out later that he had actually told, I'm not sure if it was the dispatch or if he had spoken with my SANE nurse directly.
And SANE, that's an acronym.
Mm-hmm. The sexual assault nurse examiner. I'm not sure who it was that relayed that message, but I was told that the responding officer told them that it was not a forced entry, which just was mind-blowing, and I'm pretty sure I let out a whole slew of curse words when I heard that. So,
because your memory of it, you know, you woke up to people in your apartment.
Yeah. In my bedroom, standing over me and my sleeping child. It was very much not something I had planned or invited.
The article about this in Cosmo points out that you did everything, quote unquote, right. I mean, that seems like such a strange concept.
Mm-hmm. And it's something I don't even like saying because I hate that there's this notion of a right way to be a victim or this idea of a perfect gold standard victim. And the fact that you can do everything that rape myth tells you you're supposed to do and it's still not taken seriously, whereas people kind of expect that if you were drinking or if you were in some way involved with the person or there was any other type of potential motive that you're going to be suspect in the situation. It's really frustrating.
So let's move on from your apartment. Where did you go from there?
The EMTs took me to, I believe it was Center Point Hospital for the rape exam.
And is from there you ended up with police in an interview kind of situation, right?
Not until the next day. That was that morning that I had the sexual assault kit done, and then another day passed, and then I was interviewed.
So what's your sense of why there was such a lag time?
I can speculate a whole number of reasons. I think a lot of it was that I just wasn't what they expected from a victim, and they didn't believe me. I mean, that's how I feel, is that they didn't believe me, that they felt there were too many holes in the case and they didn't want to proceed with it. I think the fact that I knew local legislators and that I was very public about the process and what was happening, that they started to take it more seriously in an effort to kind of cover their butts.
So that's how you felt while this was going on.
Yeah.
In that time, I mean, the next step involves you being interviewed by police. And the reporter of that Cosmo article I've referenced a couple of times, Andy Kopsa, reviews police tapes with you in the article. What was it that you relived in those tapes?
There's like a desperation to be believed.
How do you see that in yourself when you see yourself on the television screen while watching that documentation?
I notice that I pull my sleeves down a lot when I get uncomfortable and when I feel like I'm trying to make a point and I'm not being heard. I look heavy and tired and uncomfortable, and the, like, this is going to be something that's going to weigh on me for a long time, because it felt like I was fighting for my humanity. Like, I was fighting to be believed. And I think that my detective did the best he could to formulate a situation, I think, that was traumatic for me, but not necessarily a criminal thing that he needed to prosecute. Like, he was sympathetic, and but it still felt like he was trying to poke holes in my story, or like it was.
Can you give an example?
Unfortunately, because it's still a pending case, I don't want to really reveal those details.
Yeah.
But yeah, it just, yeah, it's tough to explain.
What do you think that people who haven't been through this kind of experience, and thank God, may not understand about the need for officers, you know, how that need for officers to cross their T's, dot their I's, can really push up against the vulnerability of someone in your position? I mean, considering what you've just gone through.
Yeah, I think it's difficult because there's definitely things that the officers need to ask me that are uncomfortable for me to answer. And there's, at the same time, they need to be investigating under the assumption that a crime happened and not be investigating a way to, I don't know, delegitimize the claim, if that makes sense.
Talk though more about what it feels like when people are trying to make sure this really happened.
Because it happened to me, like it was an experience that I had and it was very vivid and real to me, it's hard to really drive home that depth and that impact to somebody else who is looking at it from an investigative standpoint. I think because rape is so rarely talked about, you know, we talk about cervical cancer and breast cancer, and we talk about murders, and there's true crime stuff all over there, and it's all so personal. But when you start talking about rape, it becomes this taboo that, oh, we can't talk about that because of everything that's involved. And so
we just don't have the language, maybe.
It needs to be talked about more so people really understand the impact that it has on people and the resulting trauma and what that looks like.
Taylor Hirsch, thank you so much. I wish you all the best as you cope with this.
Thank you.
When we return, a law professor shares some insights into how stories like Taylor's fit into a bigger picture. I'm Gina Kaufman. You're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we just heard the story of an independence woman's dealings with the police when she reported that she'd been raped in her home in front of her 2-year-old daughter. I'd like to remind listeners once again that today's show deals with especially difficult subject matter. Our next guest on KCUR's Central Standard is a law professor at KU who has studied extensively not just how cases of sexual assault are handled, but why. Corey Rayburn-Young, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
What do you hear in Taylor's story that's kind of, maybe this sounds crass, but like par for the course with this kind of case? And what do you hear that's unusual, like just actually an example of things not going the way you'd expect?
Well, every story of a victim talking to the police about what happened to them is going to have differences. But there is a pattern that has emerged across the United States in cases like hers where even when, you know, the victim is entirely cooperating and doing all the things they're supposed to do in that sort of perfect victim role, there is a inherent bias, especially in certain police departments, against rape victim stories. And I think her story is typical in many important aspects because very few cases make it past the police and to a prosecutor to even look about prosecuting a case. And, you know, this is part of why We've had this enormous number, you know, over 400,000 untested rape kits in the United States because there's a lot of police and a lot of police departments who don't take these cases as seriously as they should.
So can you explain a little bit more what you mean by the perfect victim?
Well,
it's very creepy sounding.
It is. It is. And I think it's, you know, what we know about victims in general, particularly those that have been traumatized, is that their behavior will vary because each of us copes with trauma and, you know, horrible things happening in different ways. But rape victims in particular can show sometimes polar opposite behavior. And so some victims are afraid to be touched afterwards and don't want any human contact. Other victims find, more connections and may become more promiscuous than they were. And both of these are within the range of what we expect because people deal with these horrible scenarios in a variety of manners. And so society, though, seems to think there is this perfect victim that would do everything right, preserve all the evidence, of course, not been drinking. But yet you see even contradictions within this perfect victim narrative. You'll see some cases where a victim will go straight to the police and they'll be like, oh, well, if she was really raped, she would have gone to the hospital first, right? But if they go to the hospital, you should have gone to the police. There just seems to be this idea of a bar for a perfect victim that's almost impossible to meet. And we still see plenty of victims who do everything that, you know, that society thought they needed to do, and yet their cases don't move forward.
In a 2016 analysis that you published under the title Rape Law Gatekeeping, you wrote this sentence: ultimately, police are the largest obstacle to the prosecution and conviction of rapists in the United States. Explain that.
Well, I should say it's not just me who has reached that conclusion, although I try to offer, you know, good support for it. But the International Association of Police Chiefs made a very similar statement that we know very few rape cases ever get prosecuted, ever lead to conviction. But what I think people are less aware of is that with the way most investigations are structured, police are accountable for the large majority of stopping points for cases not proceeding any further. And in fact, in lots of jurisdictions, rape cases are just almost never investigated. New Orleans was, you know, caught by the New York Times and their local media just openly discarding rape cases and designating them as non-criminal matters. And even after they were subject to scrutiny by the Department of Justice, in the following 3 years, they still were disposing of over 1,300 cases without any attempt to investigate them. And, I mean, if that's the norm in certain departments, but other departments, you know, it's going to depend on the officer. It's going to depend on the resources available. There's a lot of factors that make rape cases very difficult and time-consuming. And over time, a lot of institutional actors have decided, let's deprioritize those because they're just not a big cost-effective concern.
When it comes to just variation in what happens from one police officer's handling to another, our Kansas City's police chief, Daryl Forte, recently said before a large crowd that, you know, that he finds the idea of, like, the one bad apple kind of unacceptable. He said that if there was an airline that said 90% of our pilots are good pilots, they're going to get you there safely, you probably still wouldn't want to get on a plane. And so I guess I'm curious about your thoughts about that argument, about variation from one police officer to another.
Well, I mean, there's certainly great officers in, you know, every department across the country. But there are patterns that emerge and norms that reinforce themselves over time. And so surveys of police have shown that police have a much higher acceptance of various rape myths than the general population or other people involved in these cases. There was a sheriff out west who was being interviewed about the question of whether or not rape kits should be mandatory tested under a proposed state statute. And he said that's ridiculous because over half the rape cases in our jurisdiction of really consensual sex, which goes against decades of social science research that shows false reporting of rape is lower than many crimes and not a significant factor. But once that attitude develops and then gets handed down by someone who's in command, it gets reinforced. And so officers are trained, you know, you need to look at rape victims more carefully. You need to check out their story. You know, maybe this is all made up. But what's remarkable in the stories I collected and in Taylor's story, these were the types of cases that most people thought police would investigate, right? These are stranger rape cases. These are not instances of people, you know, having prior relationship or context. These are often very brutal and violent crimes. And even then, with all the hallmarks of what's supposed to be the iconic case to investigate, we still see these cases being ignored.
Why? I mean, because it sounds like what you're saying is that without having looked into the evidence, there's already an assumption that the story is not true.
I think that's the case. Or in some instances, police are trained to just find any reason to make the case go away. So like in Cleveland from 2008 to 2009, there was a man, Anthony Soule, who was eventually nicknamed the Cleveland Strangler. He was reported on many instances, at least four, by women of either raping them or attempting to rape them. In one case, they even brought the police to the house and found blood of the woman on the stairs. And they ultimately decided after arresting him to let him go because he said she attacked him first. Well, Soule was on the sex offender registry. He was a convicted rapist. He had all the usual or all the most severe categorizations for looking at him as what we think of as a usual suspect. And yet, these four different complaints were ignored until the last victim really pushed the case forward. And when they got there, they found 11 decomposing bodies in his house. I mean, one of the victims had reported seeing a decapitated head. It is amazing that even with these graphic details, even with the repetitive reporting of a person who has a prior record in this area, police just found excuses to make the case, you know, not their concern. And
I want to jump in because, I mean, it's listening to this, it is just crazy to, I mean, it sounds crazy. You've said that a lot of what happens is a result of strong cultural biases against victims of sexual assault. So biases that extend beyond law enforcement into our culture more broadly. I mean, describe those biases and how you went about studying them.
Well, I mean, thankfully, there's a lot of great researchers who've already, you know, laid the groundwork for understanding these rape myth ideas that make people distrust victims, that focus on minor inconsistencies in their story to ultimately dismiss their claims.
But why? I mean, because I understand the basic notion that maybe there has to be a lot of rigor applied to any legal question. But what I don't understand, I mean, how is this different from, say, how a person reporting a burglary or a house robbery might be questioned?
Well, it's completely different. I mean, I think the problem is we view rape victims as not just an ordinary crime victim. It enters this sort of political and culturally disputed space about what is sex, what is rape. And suddenly, police put their focus on the victim, often before even investigating further. I mean, the Washington Post reported this just horrific case where an 11-year-old was brutally gang raped. And ultimately, they not only interviewed her for hours while she was still wearing the clothes where she was abused and tried to poke holes in her story, but they prosecute her for filing a false report. And an email the Washington Post uncovered said that the parents are just upset that their daughter is promiscuous. All sex was consensual. And I'm not sure if that typo was intentional or not, but it was horrific, right? This is something that no morally sensible person would look at and say, you would conclude this case doesn't need any further investigation. All the alleged perpetrators were, you know, in their late teens or early 20s, which means at a minimum, this would be statutory rape. But I think that police have been taught over the years, both because of the beliefs about false reporting, but also the new emphasis on statistical policing in some departments, make rape cases very undesirable source or focus points, because they take a ton of time with very little likelihood of a conviction. And so if you are trying to make your numbers look better, either as a detective or as a higher rank officer, rape cases are an area that is often manipulated, where there's, you know, encouragement to make the victims, you know, withdraw their complaint. And this has been uncovered at cities across the country, from St. Louis, I mentioned New Orleans, Baltimore, Philadelphia. Great investigative journalism found that police practices were actually to make rape victims withdraw their complaints so they could treat the case as cleared and therefore make their numbers look better.
You've written that police departments undercount rape cases by calling certain complaints unfounded, even when many of them have not been investigated. I'm curious about on what basis the complaints are deemed unfounded, if not through investigation. Is there no sort of official standard for dismissing a case, or at least not moving it through the process any further?
Well, there is an official standard in the FBI's Uniform Crime Report Manual that says you're not supposed to deem a complaint unfounded unless you've engaged in a thorough and complete investigation. But police departments like Baltimore made unfounding, you know, the regular practice without any further inquiry. I mean, in many instances, you know, you certainly didn't have the rape kit tested. There was no attempt to interview the alleged perpetrator when they were known. It would just be they got the complaint from the victim, decided it wasn't worth looking into, and moved on. And that is against the way the crime is supposed to be reported to the FBI and the way it's supposed to be counted. But that's really a symptom of the deeper problem, which is these cases just don't get taken seriously.
You know, the tricky thing is that a human being has gone through what is, like, probably the most traumatic, like, experience of this person's life. And there's an emotional component to interacting with a person under those conditions, but there's also a legal component, which does require information gathering and leaving no stone unturned. Those things must be hard to reconcile.
No, I mean, I think that's true. But remember, police departments vary in their structure because of Law and Order SVU. I think a lot of America assumes that every police department has a specialized unit. But that's actually a pretty new phenomenon. And so a lot of times, you know, police officers will encounter a rape case once every now and then. And it may not be an area they're trained for, an area they're comfortable with. And they might just want to, you know, move on and get back to the actual cases that made them want to be a police officer. And so these motivations all reinforce each other to make rape investigations happen less frequently than they should.
Corey Rayburn-Young with us from KU's Law School. Thank you so much for talking about your research.
Thank you.
When we come back from the break, we'll bring former detective from the Kansas City Police Department in on this, as well as an advocate from MOXA who's seen these interactions up close. If you've had an experience that sheds light on what happens when sexual assault is reported, call us up. We want to know what we're missing. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're trying to get a handle today on what happens when rapes are reported to police. With two-thirds of cases going unreported, we want to know how the experiences victims have with law enforcement might be a contributing factor, explaining why so many people choose not to go that route. We're taking your calls at 816-235-2888. Catherine Johnson, good morning.
Morning.
Catherine was formerly a detective with the Kansas City Police Department. And Catherine, how did you get involved in rape and sexual assault cases?
Well, I became a police officer in 2002, and my goal was always to become a detective. And these cases, I felt a passion for, and began working my way to become a detective. And in 2006, I had the opportunity to go to the sex crimes unit and become a detective for the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department.
So what was your role as a detective? I mean, you understand what that means, but my idea of a detective is sadly informed by like old timey novels and such.
Unfortunately, the media does impact the way people view law enforcement and specifically investigations. The role of a detective is really to be a non-biased fact finder. A detective should not be taking sides. They should be looking at the facts of a case and leaving no stone unturned and literally looking, following every lead that they get. And the practice that I made daily was to do every case every time. Opinions don't matter. If there's a fact to be investigated or a lead to be looked at, you follow it.
Do you have the sense that that was more broadly the practice in how rape cases were handled by the Kansas City Police Department during your time there?
I can only speak to the way my squad worked, and I can tell you my squad, that's how we worked. That's how our supervisors required it. That's what was expected of us. Our supervisors reviewed every case before it was closed, and if they felt like it shouldn't be closed, they sent it back to us and said, no, you need to follow up on this lead or that lead. But one of the things that I can tell you I did personally is the department's training wasn't enough. And every opportunity that I had to get education and training from other sources, I jumped at it. And then I would bring that training and education that I learned back to my unit and help give other detectives the same information so that they could also improve their job.
And I want to get back to Catherine shortly, but Angie Blummel, I want to introduce you as well. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Angie is coming to us having been the director of advocacy for MOXA. So Angie, locally, we know now how detectives might come into this. How do MOXA volunteers enter into the picture during the reporting of a rape case?
That's a great question. So a Metropolitan Organization to Counter Sexual Assault, or MOXA, is the area's rape crisis center, and we serve victims from early childhood all the way through elder adulthood. So our role is to provide support to survivors of sexual violence, both at the hospital while receiving a sexual assault forensic exam, and also perhaps when they're reporting to law enforcement. And sometimes those things can occur together at the hospital.
Does the victim have to pursue your involvement actively, or are you just called in whenever there is a case of sexual assault?
So we have agreements in place with 22 area hospitals that have sexual assault forensic examiner programs that when a survivor walks through the doors of the emergency room and indicates they need an exam, a MOX advocate is automatically called. And we show up anytime, day or night, introduce ourselves, provide a little information at that time, ask the survivor, is it okay if we stay and provide support during this process? And the person is allowed to make a decision at that time, like, you know, if they have friends or family that they want to stay with them, or if they want an advocate present. And 9 times out of 10, survivors have us stay, and we provide support during that process.
So what kind of things do you tend to see in that role that that could add some clarity to what typically happens and why?
So our primary role is to meet the needs of survivors as they articulate them. And as we've heard, statistically speaking, not all survivors want to report to law enforcement. So that can look very different. We might be there providing support during the exam. We may go on to provide continual support in the survivor's life with other personal advocacy needs.
Like, what do you witness in these interactions we've been discussing between the survivor and police officers?
Mm-hmm. So reporting can look different in every situation. Sometimes police may arrive at the hospital and take the initial report during the exam process. Sometimes a survivor will wait and later go and speak with law enforcement or a detective. So it can look different each time. But every time when we are present, our focus and our role is to provide support and that compassionate presence to the survivor.
Okay, well, let's get talking to some of our callers who are sharing their stories at 816-235-2888. We've got Diana on the line. Hi, Diana. Diana, are you there? Okay, we'll
get... Can you hear me?
Now I can. Hi, Diana.
Oh, hi. Sorry about that.
Share your story with us. First of all, I mean, what have you been thinking as you've been listening to this conversation, and what experience do you have that might shed light on it?
Well, my first response to hearing these things is always sad. I don't think that will ever change, because the facts are the facts right now in our current state of affairs, and rape is not something that people are comfortable to speak about or deal with across the board. I know Moxa goes into schools and does community education, and, you know, just something that should be discussed, because it is more common than we'd like to realize, but it's still very much a topic that is not well received. My experience, I was sexually assaulted in 2007 by a man that I knew. It was my best friend's husband. And it was very traumatizing for me, because up to that point, I operated under the misconception that this only happened to certain types of people. And so I did fall into that bias category. I wasn't practicing any unsafe lifestyles. I didn't do drugs. I drank in moderation. I was a mom of two kids. And so when it happened to me, it was duly traumatizing, simply because this wasn't supposed to happen to me. And so through the whole process, I didn't have a good experience initially with the police department.
Which police department is this, just so we know?
Oh, Kansas City Police Department.
Okay, yeah, go on.
The individual who took my report didn't believe me. He accused me of being caught in an affair, and my husband was there when we went to report together, and he basically called my credibility into account. And I'm already in shock, and he told me, if this really happened, you go get an exam done. And so we did. And I'm processing all of this, and the only beautiful ray of light that came out of that evening was the simple fact that when I went in to get my exam done, they asked me if I wanted a Moxa advocate there. And at that point, I didn't know which end was up. I didn't know what they were saying. They kept throwing out acronyms. I just kept saying yes, because that was the place that I felt the safest. And I had a Moxa advocate come and hold my hand and tell me I didn't do anything wrong. And she was the first person in that entire process that believed in me.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that, Diana.
Well, it's, you know, the good that came out of it is that was the first moment I knew I really was going to be okay.
Just someone saying that you were okay, that you were going to be okay.
A total stranger just told me I was going to be okay, and it wasn't my fault. And that I knew that in my heart, but the police didn't even believe me. And with Mox's help, I went through years of therapy with them. I've become a volunteer with them, because I am very passionate about the fact that rape is not a four-letter word that we need to keep out of our home. It is something that we do need to discuss, because it's everywhere and it can happen to anyone. And, you know, it's the more I can tell people about what happened to me, the more they feel comfortable sharing or talking about their experiences or the experiences of those people they've known. Because when you don't allow the shame to be there, then it's okay to talk about it.
Diana, I have a question for you. I mean, as far as when you talk about these things, we've heard a couple of times that people aren't comfortable talking about rape. And of course, any kind of violent crime is something that has a lot of unpleasantness involved in it, but it sounds like there's a special like component to this discomfort and unpleasantness that people mm-hmm. somehow show you that they aren't wanting to hear about or talk about. Can you explain that to me? How do you witness that people don't want to talk about this or aren't comfortable talking about it?
Oh, it's visible. Their body language completely changes. They take a step back. Their face all of a sudden becomes very flat affect. They sometimes become fidgety. It's very, very prevalent in their body language. And then the conversation will shorten. But the more we talk about it and the more they realize that I'm not there to ask them questions, I'm there to identify as to what happened to me and to educate, they start to realize, okay, she seems relatively normal. She was able to discuss this with me and not make it uncomfortable or invasive in any way.
Yeah.
And so that's really the approach to it. But people visibly become uncomfortable when you start talking about rape. Sexual assault, a little bit less, but the word rape is a visible recognition.
Thanks, Diana. You know, Catherine Johnson, you know, as a former detective, how does Diana's experience factor into, like, how you remember these things being handled more broadly? And just, she's saying she had a really negative experience with the Kansas City Police Department.
And I actually remember that case and remember, Diana and I have talked at length about what happened, and it's unfortunate. One of the things that I think comes into play, law enforcement in general, when people become police officers, they do it because they want to do a good job. You don't become a cop to get rich. It just, that is not why people go into that field. The problem or the challenge that I have seen, and I've trained law enforcement for the last decade, is that there is a lack of education specifically around how to handle sexual assault investigations, how to take that initial report, how to talk to victims of sexual assault. As has been said multiple times, talking about rape makes some people very uncomfortable. And if you are a patrol officer who wants to make a difference, but you don't have the education and the knowledge on how to work with somebody who has just experienced trauma, then the likelihood of making very grave errors comes into place. Not to mention, if you were trained by someone who buys into the rape myths, then they're getting wrong education. And so I don't think most, obviously some do, but most officers don't want to harm others. They don't want to do bad by a victim, but they just don't have the education on how trauma impacts recall and how trauma impacts a person's ability to explain what their experience was. Go ahead.
Do you have the sense that there is, like, we've heard about from another guest that this is different from how people would be approached if the kind of crime they were reporting was a different kind of crime, like, say, a burglary or house robbery? What is your sense of why, even without specific training, someone would be approached in the way that Diana's describing?
I think a lot of it comes from media and culture. And if you look at the way it is portrayed in, you know, on normal media outlets, even Law and Order SVU, if you look at the types of rape cases that they portray on that show, they are all almost always stranger, or there's some other kind of immense physical injury that leaves very little doubt as to what occurred. And we know offenders only use the amount of force necessary to control their victim. And so when you have these officers who are expecting to see this TV rape victim, and what they have in front of them is a person who is obviously injured, but maybe doesn't have a bruise on their face or other outward signs of injury, they get confused. And unfortunately, sometimes they react inappropriately and wrongly. The other thing is, law enforcement has to ask difficult questions. And what I would love to see is more education on how to approach those difficult topics and those difficult questions in a way that leaves a victim with dignity and respect, because they don't have to be cruel to ask the questions.
Angie Blummel, do you have any response to this? I mean, we've just heard a lot there, but I know you've witnessed a lot of these interactions.
I just want to say that when we don't believe survivors, we as a community, perpetrators' behaviors go unchecked, and they're not held accountable, and that's unsafe for our community and for all of us. So I think as a community, we have an opportunity, all of us, not only law enforcement, but family members, friends, employers, supporters, to believe survivors and hold perpetrators accountable.
Our time is up, but thank you to everyone who contributed to this conversation. Angie Blummel, Katherine Johnson, thank you both so much.
Thank you, Gina.
Our conversation will be online at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Share it with anyone you think might be interested in what our guests had to say this morning. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. You can also talk to us on Twitter anytime. We are at @KCURCST. If you are a regular listener of Central Standard, you might be interested in a new podcast. It includes some of the stories that have aired on this show, but transforms them into something new, a podcast about life in the Midwest in its infinite and zany variety. None of the hokey platitudes you're used to hearing. It's called Midwesternish. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman.